Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our panel discussion on policymaking in times of conflict and instability. It's a matter, clearly, of critical importance for the Middle East and Central Asia region, where even if we don't see it on the news...
Conflict not only disrupts lives, but wars and social unrest, even political instability, disrupts economies. And while this is true everywhere, the economic impact of conflict in the Middle East and Central Asia has proven larger and longer lasting than other regions. In today's episode, we present a slightly abridged version of a discussion among seasoned development experts and diplomats about the scourge of conflict and instability in today's world and what to do about it. The discussion, held during the IMF World Bank spring meetings, is moderated by CNN International's Julia Chatterley.
Let me introduce our esteemed panel, who hopefully are going to have all the answers, and forgive the abbreviated version of what is astonishing CVs. First, Professor Ghassan Salameh, renowned author and professor of the International Relations at Sciences Po Paris and founding dean of its Paris School for International Affairs. Lord Mark Malik Brown, president, Open Society Foundations, former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations and former UK government minister. And Dr. Rola Dashti, UN Under-Secretary General and the Executive Secretary of Economic Social Commission for Western Asia. Welcome. Okay, it's not just one nation that we're talking about. It's several, although I apologize for the fact that obviously what we're seeing between Israel and Gaza is dominating the headlines at this moment. But can we start by talking more broadly? What do we need to prioritize? What do we need to think about when we're talking about stabilizing a conflict zone?
Well, if you look at Gaza, the first idea that comes to mind is that humanitarianism has been devalued as an instrument of war and of diplomacy. Therefore, the most urgent thing is to bring back humanitarianism as a domain that is independent from war and so famine, destruction of hospitals, destruction of schools, all this are humanitarian issues that should be outside conflict and outside diplomacy. And on top of that, when you have international humanitarian law, you cannot apply it in a very selective way. You have to apply it in Ukraine with the same strengths you apply it in Gaza. Therefore, there is a big issue in Gaza that cannot be avoided anymore. Humanitarians has been, to a large extent, devalued by the behavior of the occupying power. If you go elsewhere, you have other issues. One issue we have in countries like Iraq and Syria, etc., is the very negative effect of regime change. We should repudiate very clearly the idea that we can do regime change by force or indirectly. We have to accept the idea that the world has seen a wave of democratization that went well until around 2006. And since that time, authoritarianism has been resilient in a number of countries. And therefore, we need to imagine a new form of peaceful coexistence with authoritarianism rather than trying to push a crusade for democracy that produces failed state, as is the case in countries like Syria or like Iraq. If you go into Sudan, you have another issue, the issue of indifference. The international community, if such a thing exists, I have my doubts.
I was going to ask, the we in this, by the way, is the international community, just to be clear.
Has shown a huge level of indifference to that conflict, which is a very complex conflict. It's not just a battle between two generals. It's much, much deeper than that. So indifference is much worse than hostility. And indifference shows that there is some kind of fatigue with the other's conflict. And Sudan needs concern. It needs people who care about it and who work for it and support the civilians in taking their share in rebuilding the country rather than leave it to two generals to sort of displace half of the population, destroy the capital city, and bring Sudan into full collapse.
Lord Malik Brown, what we heard there is we need more humanity, I think, in general, in terms of addressing these conflicts, and perhaps we need to care equally about all conflicts rather than just some more than others. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely the case. I mean, the current conflict in Sudan was a year old this week. And, you know, actually there's a higher level of displacement and more deaths than when Darfur was a top of mind conflict 20 years ago. And yet you wouldn't know it because this time there's zero attention. Then, even though you had a divided geopolitics because this was the era of the Iraq war, nevertheless, on Sudan, George Bush, Tony Blair, and people who disagreed with them profoundly over Iraq made common cause. President Obasanjo, President Mbeki, many other regional leaders, many other European leaders all came together to try and find a solution, imperfectly, but there was that level of attention. So, yes, to Hassan's point about the even application and consistent application of humanitarian law, yes, also to leadership of a kind that generation of world leaders did show, and this one doesn't. But third, I think, you know, going beyond that, to recognize, and this is where the fund and the bank are so important, you know, humanitarianism was based on the idea that conflict is temporary, and then you go back to development. And the instruments that the fund and the bank have designed have reflected that. A view, 3 or 4 year stabilization program if you're the fund and then life's back to normal. Or if you're the bank, well, it's humanitarians time, wait till there are government institutions we can lend to and we can do a more regular routine program. I think we all have to understand that conflict is becoming the daily life in large parts of the world, and we need a set of instruments which blend humanitarian and development around the proposition these are long-term conflicts and need long-term approaches.
We'll come back to that. Your opinion on prioritization and what we've said here about, I think, a change in mindset, actually. The right policies, humanity, caring more.
You see, it's the issue also, building on what Ghassan and Mark saying, is that these conflicts are not internal conflicts. A good portion of them are proxy, regional proxy, or international interventions. So when you want to get these solutions to go into sustainable peace, so it's more than the actors of the local actors itself. So, and unfortunately, what we see is that regional actors or international interventions, when they come to resolve the issue, they don't resolve it for sustainable peace and inclusive growth. So it's a temporary solution, temporary fixes, so that after 10, 15 years, that region comes back into another conflict. So what we need to have to lay the foundation of sustainable peace, inclusive growth, sustainable peace, justice, and long-term stability. And these have different dimensions of priority. When we're talking about inclusive peace, sustainable peace, it means we need to build trust, not internal trust between citizens and leadership and the politicians, but also trust between countries, regional actors. And so now, how do we build trust between regional actors together? Here comes, for example, and the World Bank and can play a role in regional projects. And key regional projects, we're talking about connectivities projects, we're talking about water scarcity, which is, could be a potential conflict. So this is where can be building trust, but also create some sustainability on the other thing. The second part is the inclusive growth. And here the role of the World Bank and the IMF and others, because huge after conflict, you will see huge investments coming into infrastructures. But unfortunately, these investments in infrastructure usually tends to marginalize the root causes of citizens and groups that are already were in conflict and been marginalized. So we need to look into local needs assessments. We need to focus on where these investments are to ensure that groups are not marginalized again so that they can benefit from these investments. I'll tell you something. In the last 10 years, countries which have conflicts, for example, real per capita income has decreased dramatically. In Libya, it decreased almost 50%.
Right.
In Sudan, 40%. So people are suffering in that region. We have 70 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid. At the time, now, the humanitarian aid to the region, okay, is been reduced dramatically. We're talking about now we're getting 30 or 40% of the humanitarian aid that we used. Can you imagine what's the impact on the host community? How we're talking about almost 35 million IDPs. So you have a generation, also you're losing a generation.
And more.
And more. A lot alone to talk about social reconciliation, you're talking about social cohesion. These are key issues. It's not economy only. It's the social dimension also, which is extremely important to reconcile and to integrate so that to prevent future conflict.
Okay, I could pick any of them. Yemen, Ethiopia, Sudan. We've talked about Sudan, so I'm going to pick that again. Can you map what we were just hearing there and tell me how you would fix Sudan and do that at the same time, those steps in terms of priorities?
I think you have two enemies. You have first bureaucracy and second foreign interference. And you have two friends, creativity and mixing of leverage. I worked in Libya, and I want to give it as an example.
Please.
In Libya, I wanted to stabilize the currency exchange rate. First, it's not my business, because I was a UN guy. It should be the IMF guy. But to think
to think that
you can separate the two was stupid. So I had a ceasefire to produce among militias in 2018 between Tripoli on the one hand, Misrata and Talhouna on the other hand. I put as number four in the ceasefire agreement, the government was begging me to produce, stabilization of the currency rate. It shouldn't be there. But I knew that this was the only way to impose it on the government. Second, it was not my business to reunify the central bank. I worked hard in order to have one central bank in Libya and not two. Why? Because you know that it is not a question of persuasion, it's a question of leverage. Three, the humanitarian issue. Nobody in Libya is interested in the humanitarian issue, though there is a big humanitarian issue for non-Libyans, for those who are trying to cross the Mediterranean. Something I learned in Libya is that the Mediterranean is not a place only to go and have some tanning. It's a place which is also a cemetery for those who try to cross it. And I think the question of migration is something that it cannot be handled by the Libyans and should be handled independently from them. And this what also we tried to do. Therefore, you need to have ad hoc solution. Four or five. You need to have the relevant party in the conflict and not the institutions you are familiar with. The Security Council is made of a number of people. It so happened when the war started in Libya that no one among those who were interfering in Libya were present in the Security Council. Not Turkey, not Egypt, not the UAE, not all those countries interfering in Libya. So I organized a summit outside the Security Council in order to make sure that those who are interested in Libya come. That was the Berlin summit of January 2020. And then you implement it. We implemented the oil part and oil was produced. We implemented the security part through a very ad hoc situation, a ceasefire produced by five officers from two sides, the 5+5 formula. Then came the election. I was not in a hurry to produce election. I'm not in a hurry to produce election now either. I think that I learned from Iraq 20 years earlier that early election can be very divisive. And if you cannot secure the safety of every candidate and every voter, you should not organize election.
Okay.
Therefore, you leave your textbook somewhere in a drawer and you try to settle the situation as it is, which means you need to have a very sort of personal, but a very studied diagnosis of the situation you are facing. I would do the same in Sudan if I go see what is at stake and not only the what you read in the newspaper and try to find a common ground for a solution.
Okay. this is the point. So what we're saying is there is no prescription. So despite my best efforts, we're not going to get a policy prescription that can be mapped on each country because each country is different. And I think this is a critically important point. The financiers, the backers, the vested interests are different in each sphere. Is there a bare minimum, however, to your point, whether it's the United Nations, some form of collection of international community that can be useful in each of these spheres, perhaps? And bringing it back to the economics, to what Rola was saying about providing some degree of hope and stabilization for an economy that sees, for example, a 50% drop in its GDP. Everybody's suffering. Poverty, no jobs, wages, instability of the currency. What's the bare minimum required to provide some degree of stabilization? Because if there isn't that, people are going to fight over resources, never mind power.
You have it in every country different from the other. In the Libyan case, again, one thing that people underestimate is that Gaddafi is probably the first leader who established a UBI that is working very well in Libya, a universal basic income. Basically, everybody who's 18 plus, has a salary. And therefore, the two-thirds of the budget are devoted to fund this UBI. So your first duty is to preserve the UBI, because civil peace is dependent on UBI that has been put in place by the dictator, but still working. So again, you are angry with regime change from abroad, because sometimes it destroys the whole. In this case, we were able to fund. In Iraq, in 2003, we discovered that the oil for food system was extraordinarily well organized by the Iraqi government. And you can rely on it in order to feed the population. So therefore, the over-politicization sometimes kills institutions that are working and should be preserved. And that is why you need wisdom and prudence when you approach these countries, and some kind of humility. And that is why I'm very angry with those who want to export democracy at any price, because sometimes you go for regime change and you end up with failed states.
And we have to try and find policy to move on from that moment. We can't fix that here, but I hear you. Lord Malik Brown, can you give your perspective, and it's sort of a more international perspective versus, in this case, being sort of so intimately involved with a nation. What can we learn from previous mistakes and perhaps, to your earlier point, find ways to progress in better forms, whether it's international bodies or the international community?
Yeah, I think you've sort of slightly overreacted to Hassan's point about leave your rule book behind. Because I don't think you're saying there are no principles. There are principles, which is resource the response adequately over a long, sustained period of time. Have a set of instruments that can be deployed by those in charge of the response. But then, above all, understand that each crisis is different. Well, you know, there's nobody in the development space or other spaces who wouldn't argue that that's always the case. You know, the solution for a loan to Egypt is going to be different to the solution for a loan to Tunisia. So I think, you know, what we need is sufficient political and financial attention to these issues to have a response that is of the scale needed. So, you know, for example, on Sudan, the current UN humanitarian appeal for the country is 3.2% funded.
Yeah.
You know, which is an indication of just the lack of serious attention or will or commitment. But I think, you know, what I would say as a veteran of having been around these crises for a long time, when I started, and I started as the humanitarian end, working for the High Commissioner for Refugees, you know, the first round of countries I was placed in, Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam, South Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central America, the Horn of Africa, you know, I have seen and East Africa. I've seen a lot of countries which are unrecognizable to how they were when I began, and I'm not that old. But the point is, you know, that there has been dramatic improvement. But I would also say that in nearly all of the countries I was involved in my 20s and 30s, you still see some of the ghosts of the past there. You know, Rwanda has just acknowledged 30 years after its genocide. It is an extraordinary powerhouse of economic development. Its success with social indicators like education, life expectancy, healthcare are extraordinary. But it is in some ways still an authoritarian state.
But that goes to Kwesi's point, though, about, you know, sometimes you can't fix the politics of the situation, but there are improvements that you can make. Is that perhaps what connects some of the
success?
Well,
I think it is because, you know...
Vietnam, Cambodia.
Because there's a reason that you've still got authoritarian leadership in Rwanda, which is, you know, the fundamental dispute between the Tutsis and the Hutus actually, to some extent, remains. But I think what's remarkable is, in just a couple, well, April the 7th, which was the 30th anniversary, President Kagame gave an extraordinary speech where basically he said, you know, we've spent a lot of time blaming the French, Bill Clinton, the UN for what happened, but we're now starting to fix it because we've started to look at ourselves. We've turned the mirror around. We've looked at our own, his metaphor was the arrow faced out to complain about these external critics. Now we've turned it inwards to recognize that the long-term solution to a peaceful society in Rwanda is not in the hands of the Americans or the French or the UN. It's ultimately in our own hands to find ways to live peacefully together with each other. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be learned from this about local leadership, local reconciliation, but for the international community, us in this room, you know, the bit never to forget is, yes, you need great leadership that understands that, both international and local leadership, but you do need to have the political will and the humanity and the solidarity and conscience to resource what needs to be done to scale.
You mean domestically or you mean internationally?
Internationally.
Do we have that today? I mean, look at UN
security. My example was you know, Sudan, 3.2% funded, a Security Council that can barely agree what time to meet, let alone how to fix
they can agree to disagree.
A global problem. You know, so, you know, our institutions are in a terrible way. And, you know, would actually say, and you know, someone who has worked both at the World Bank and in the UN, you know, there are times when the institutions here look weak because they seem a little bit too Western and American dominated, and the UN can look refreshingly sort of broadly owned with a multiple constituency of ownership. Now is one of those moments when the pendulum is the other way. I think the bank and the fund are incredibly important institutions because they do enjoy a degree of international consensus. They do have a capacity and power to act, whereas the cousins up the road in New York are pretty much tragically sidelined for now.
Well, I come in here because you have the perfect example of the experience to respond to that in many respects, and it is about the member states. Even as, you know, I frequently get guests on who are ranting about the United Nations as a body in of itself rather than understanding it's the member states. So we'll make that point first and foremost. But it does make operating in whatever environment we're talking about incredibly difficult.
We do deliver, aside from the member states' decision and the functionality of the Security Council.
It doesn't stop the work that you're doing on the ground every day.
It doesn't stop the work of the UN institutions to deliver on their mandates on various things. I mean, in the region now, the humanitarian UNHCR, OCHA, are delivering for the millions of people in terms of getting their basic needs of it. Yes, now we're suffering from funding on that things, but the issue is the problem is not only the 70 million who are dependent on humanitarian aid, but also the host communities. So we're now, and this is the responsibility of the international community. also to bring funding, not only because now you will destabilize economies or stabilize countries, because in the absence of also ensuring that there is enough financing to support the refugees and the internally displaced individuals. But let's go back. It's the core. Yes, there is part of it is politics, but part of it also, I do agree with Mark, that countries need to look inward also, because a good portion of the problem, of the conflict, is internal issues in terms of a government to deliver to their citizens, in terms of engagement and the participation of the youth and the women in the decision-making processes itself in the country, in the reshaping of the future of its of the nation. They need to be part of the development of their countries. Now, you can't exclude the women, the youth, from aspiring and be part of implementing their aspiration and developing the economy of their country. Exclusion, resources, and I think in times of conflict, social cohesion, social reconciliation becomes a key issue. And economics, economics can be driver and a catalyst for social cohesion and social reconciliation through local needs assessment. And I think now we need to look at the local level, not at the central level, when you're looking into these conflict resolutions and stability within a country, because these investments needs to go directly to the local communities. And this where the drivers, the economy drivers becomes, and the investments becomes a part, because economy brings people together, because there will be shared interest. And this will facilitate the social reconciliation, it facilitates the social cohesion, and it addresses what is the key drivers, because within the country, it's not every localization is the same key drivers, economic key drivers. Like, let's take in Syria. There are certain areas in Syria, it could be small businesses is the economic driver, which brings people. In other places, it's tourism. And the cultural tourism is... So you, is it, even within the country, it's not one type policy.
What's the best investment, then, on a local level? I mean, a job is a great reason to not be fighting. On a very basic level, what's the best way to invest, whether it's the fund or anybody else, to create that on a ground level economic opportunity?
Well, I had the privilege in Gaza of twice cementing down a stone, the first stone nor brick to create an airport in Gaza. Why did I do it twice? Because the Israelis blew it up the first time. And I wasn't allowed, I wasn't around long enough as administrator of UNDP to do it a third time. And so, you know, of course it's going to be difficult for a private sector which sees, you know, this kind of, you know, war each time.
Repetitive.
Repeating cycles, destroying the infrastructure, destroying whatever capital value, income value it was going to have. And so, you know, I sometimes think this appeal to the private sector to make up the difference in conflict countries is a little bit, you know, to be honest, a cry into the face of a wind blowing strongly the other direction. You know, I think if we look at the sort of global flows, public and private, you know, we may have to accept that a huge majority of the international, large-scale private flows are going to be directed towards more stable countries, and that therefore there should be an over-concentration of public flows, international public flows, on exactly those non-investable conflict-like countries. Now, I said big flows for an obvious reason, that I think on things like, you know, small enterprise job creation, remittance earnings and other flows which can come strongly during a conflict period from expats abroad sending money home to their families can be a huge source of SME creation in conflicts. I mean, and, you know, we tend to have these very kind of old-fashioned views of what a conflict country looks like. We assume, you know, that it's a complete battlefield, everything's flattened, and in somewhere like Gaza it is. But for years, Somalia was a failed state with an incredibly successful set of local indigenous institutions which were sending expat monies home, where they were being turned into very dynamic job creation, SME development patterns, Somaliland even more. And it looked totally different to the Western assumption that, you know, militias were all over the country killing at each other's throat and there was no economic activity. We have to accept the uncomfortable truth that sometimes in war, there's a huge amount of economic activity. So again, it goes to Hassan's point. You have to look at each of these conflicts in a very forensic, surgical, detailed way and be deeply respectful of local leadership and its suggestion of what political business community leaders in the country believe would be most helpful to them to build things. And one final point on this, I mean, it's also the case that if you look at the development of institutions in conflict and post-conflict countries, they're not usually classic top-down from the central capital city ministries of this, that, and the other. They're a much more community-based, bottom-up, kind of development approach where community groups form the nucleus of service delivery and, you know, may over time, you know, provide a much more effective long-term solution to service delivery than the Ministry of Education in the distant capital. Again, you need conflict funding tools which recognize that sort of heterodox hybrid nature of government development in those kinds of contexts?
Well, as far as Gaza is concerned, we badly need public foreign capital to go for the imminent needs of the population. The disaster that has been created in the past 6 months of a magnitude that no private money can handle, you will need many billions of dollars immediately in order at least to cater for the most imminent, most acute humanitarian needs in terms of medical services, in terms of food, and in terms of the beginning of a reconstruction, at least of homes.
And the UN's now saying $18 billion.
When you go a bit further, you need something completely different. You will need first to reattach Gaza to the West Bank. Gaza is not a story of its own. It has been created as such by the Israeli government in the past 15 years. Gaza is part and parcel of the Palestinian people. And if there is no political solution for Gaza as such, and it has been tried in the 14 years, and we are witnessing now the end of that policy, the death of the policy that wants to colonize the West Bank and eventually annex it, by keeping Gaza as far as you can from the general story. So you need a solution for the Palestinian people and not for Gaza when you have dealt first with the imminent and urgent humanitarian needs. But let me make a jump and say private sector is something you need in non-conflict situations. If you look at how the private sector is being dealt with, you are not very happy in other countries. I'm not talking here about Palestine or Sudan or even Syria. In other countries, you will find that a military leadership is not very open to share public works with private companies. In other countries, you find a local kleptocracy that we all have been happy to have because it is fighting with us in the war on terror. So we close our eyes to the way it is concentrating wealth in its hands. So we need to look at private sector not only in conflict and post-conflict situation, but in what I call a pre-conflict situations.
Let me come up on Gaza, and you're mentioning the $80 billion. It's more important is the policies that is accompanying the reconstruction. Today in Gaza, let me give you a figure. In 2021, 1,600 homes were demolished. Over the last 2 years, almost 700 were able to build. because of the siege on entering the construction products and the material. So can you imagine now we're talking about 90% of these homes are demolished totally. Yeah. And what? So there is not only the availability of the funds, it's as much as it's important, but the policies that's governed so that the reconstruction could be effective and impactful. Otherwise, we're talking about 50, 70 years, okay? And you're talking about, that's why I'm saying going back to business as usual is not going to be sustainable unless if you want to have Gaza and Palestine is, to be peaceful country as we go along. I'll go back to other countries also. Institutions, building the institutions is very key. And this is where I think we need to invest. It's not important only to invest in having the capital itself, but if you don't have a proper institutions and transparent and good governed institution that serves the people, okay, you're going back again to another conflict down the line on 15. So institutions are very key. And also investing in the people, the bureaucrats themselves, is very key. For they, because they are the ones who are going to be entrusted of the rebuilding. Mm. So this is a precondition. If you don't have this, these funds that are coming are just going to be, their impact will be short-lived impact.
Yeah, it's about balancing the short term and the money that you provide with the right policies to try and shore up the economy. And that goes actually to the displacement problem as well. If you can somehow manage to stabilize the economy and keep people there, it's easier. It's still a cost, but it's easier to fund them there rather than in other nations. And it puts pressure on those too. We have a couple of minutes left. So now it's a quick fire round. What gives you hope? If you can just give me 1 minute, what gives you hope? Is it the examples that we talked about that 2-3 decades on actually have found their way forward and seen some form of greater and more stable growth and prosperity? Or is it hope for better days?
The youth.
The youth, yes.
The youth.
Good answer. Because they'll find a way.
Well, what gives me hope, strangely, is the failures. And I'll tell you why. Because each failure, whether it's now Sudan, you know, after a long period of conflict where there was a real opportunity, Sudanese young people raced home to try and build a new Sudan, and regional countries couldn't help themselves. They jumped in and exploited the differences and took sides. The West just simply didn't engage with sufficient force, authority, and resources, didn't even lift sanctions here in Washington until way too late. And so, you know, what I see each time when peace fails is human failures of leadership internationally and domestically. And that means if you can fix leadership, you can solve problems. And, you know, I see through youth, but also youth coming up in most countries, no longer through the old political parties, whether it's the US or Sudan, or recently in West Africa in, you know, elections. What we're seeing time after time is social movements with young leaders who are driving change in their countries and now starting to come into the mainstream of political leadership. And, you know, that's my hope for the future.
Yeah, I was about to say, I can't even ask you about fixing this generation of leadership, but we'll hope for the younger generations, quite frankly. final word.
Well, I think the Middle East is a mosaic, and the Global South is also the mosaic. Mm-hmm. And that gives me hope, because it means that there are conflict areas, tragedies areas, but there are some other areas we don't talk about where things are going rather well. Private sector is active. There is no obsession with migration. There is some kind of political stability, not necessarily democratic, but stability. And there is a growth rate that is acceptable. There are now 60 to 70 countries where these criteria apply. Therefore, the world, we happen to talk about conflict areas, but the rest of the world is, I would say, okay. So my hope is that the Middle East and the Global South in general does not have a single color, green or blue or a beautiful color, because this will not happen, but that it remains enough of a mosaic that we can bring some of the countries in this mosaics from the minus category into the plus one.
My hope is SDG colors.
Yeah. Sustainability. My hope is if we keep talking about it, the crisis countries and the good side, we shed more light on it. And in the end, hopefully we find solutions. Your panel, ladies and gentlemen.
That was CNN International's Julia Chatterley moderating a panel discussion on policymaking in times of conflict and instability. You'll find a webcast of the entire event at imf.org. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.